You're listening to 90 Day Soulmate with the Relationship Engineers, Jim Golnick and Lisette Guevara, only on LA Talk Radio.
Soulmate. Today, we're talking about hypnotism and hypnosis. The difference between myth and madness. Have you ever watched a stage hypnotist and found yourself leaning forward in your seat, wondering if what you were seeing could possibly be real? The lights dim. A dozen volunteers leave the audience and climb up onto the stage. Some are laughing. Others look a little nervous. The hypnotist asks everyone to focus on the sound of his voice. Within minutes, a few people appear to drift into a trance. One volunteer suddenly can't remember her own name. Another insists she's vacationing on a tropical beach while shivering from an imaginary blizzard. Moments later, somebody is barking like a dog and the audience is doubled over with laughter. It looks impossible. It looks as though one person has somehow taken control of another person's mind. But have they? Could someone really make you do something against your will? Could they erase your memory, force you to reveal your deepest secrets, or even convince you to commit a crime? Movies have told us that they can. Stage performers sometimes seem to prove it. But does science actually say? Tonight, we're separating myth from reality and madness as we explore the psychology's oldest and most fascinating and most misunderstood subjects. By the end of this journey, I think you'll be surprised by what hypnosis is really about, and also more surprised by what it isn't. To answer these questions, we need to travel back more than 200 years. Imagine stepping from a horse-drawn carriage onto the cobblestone streets of Paris in the late 1700s. The city buzzes with excitement. People aren't talking politics, they're talking about miracles. Wealthy families, military officers, scholars, and even members of the royal court are all whispering the same name, Franz Anton Mesmer. Mesmer isn't known as a magician. He's a physician. People claim he can cure illnesses that have baffled other doctors. Blindness, chronic pain, paralysis, emotional suffering. Patients arrive desperate. Many leave insisting they've been transformed. In an age before antibiotics, before x-rays, before anesthesia, hope itself is powerful medicine, and Mesmer appears to have discovered something the rest of the medical world cannot explain. Now picture yourself walking into Mesmer's treatment room. Unlike any doctor's office you've ever seen, thick curtains soften the daylight. Candles flicker against polished wood walls. Strange, haunting music drifts through the room from an instrument called a glass harmonica. In the center of the room sits a large wooden tub filled with bottles of water and iron filings. Metal rods extend into the tub. Each patient gently holds one of these rods while sitting shoulder to shoulder with complete strangers. He slowly walks around the room without rushing. He touches a patient on the shoulder here and there, and sometimes he just looks into their eyes. The room gets silent. Then something unexpected happens. People begin to tremble. One woman starts to burst into tears. A man says the pain in his back has vanished. Others describe warmth flowing through their arms, tingling their hands, emotions they've never experienced. Mesmer tells them they're feeling an invisible force that flows through every living thing. He calls it animal magnetism. Most of the people in the room don't question him. They're convinced they've just felt it themselves. Word spreads quickly all throughout Paris, at dinner parties and cafes inside the royal palace. Everyone seems to know someone who's been helped by Mesmer. Patients who walked in with canes now claim they're walking without pain. Others insist lifelong ailments have simply disappeared. His waiting room and his business has grown larger every week. Some people travel for days just to sit in the mysterious room and hold one of those metal rods. But not everyone is convinced. Other physicians begin asking uncomfortable questions. If this invisible force is real, Why can't anyone measure it? Why do some patients improve while others don't? Is Mesmer discovering a new law of nature? Or are people experiencing something else entirely? The debate becomes so intense that it eventually reaches King Louis XVI. The king decides there's only one way to settle the argument. Stop listening to opinions and start looking for evidence. The king chooses an extraordinary group of men to investigate Mesmer's claim. One of them you probably is somebody you know about, the last person you probably expect, Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin, who flew the famous kite experiment with the key and the lightning and helped found the United States. At the time, Franklin is living in France as America's ambassador. And throughout Europe, he is respected as one of the great scientific minds of the age. Franklin isn't interested in embarrassing Mesmer. In fact, if animal magnetism truly exists, he probably would love to discover it. New discoveries are what scientists live for. So he and the others ask a very simple question. How do we know people are responding to an invisible force and not simply to what they expect to happen? That question may sound ordinary today, but it would become one of the most important questions of the history of psychology. Imagine you're one of the volunteers. You're told that the treatment is about to begin. Everyone around you is watching, and you close your eyes. And within moments, you begin feeling warmth in your hands. Your heart beats a little faster. There's a tingling sensation moving up your arms. You honestly believe something is happening inside your body. Except there's one small problem. Nothing has been done. No magnetic treatment, no invisible force, no special procedure. The investigators simply told you it was happening. Now they reverse the experiment. This time they quietly perform the same treatment just as Mesmer instructed, but they don't tell you. Most of the volunteers sit there waiting and feel almost nothing. Benjamin Franklin reaches a more remarkable, really remarkable conclusion. People are not pretending. Their experiences are genuine, but the invisible force doesn't appear to exist. Somehow the mind itself can create the very real sensations simply because it expects something to happen. More than two centuries later, psychologists are still studying the extraordinary ability. Think about how remarkable that discovery really is. Franklin didn't prove people were lying. He proved something much more interesting. People could honestly experience changes in their body without the explanation they believed was causing them. In other words, Mesmer may have been wrong about why his patients improved, without being completely wrong about the fact that many of them actually did feel better. That realization opened an entirely new mystery. If invisible, magnetic forces weren't responsible, then what was? What could cause pain to lessen, muscles to relax, emotions to change, simply because a person believed something was happening? For almost 50 years, that question remained unanswered until a Scottish surgeon attended what he thought would be nothing more than an evening stage demonstration. His name was James Braid, and he would change the conversation forever.
Victoria experiences the past, present, and future while sleeping. Will she be able to decipher the mystery of the symbols, messages, and images of her dreams before it is too late? Discover the lives she lives while Victoria dreams.
Soon she went on a perfect date, and then she knew it must be fate. In just 90 days, that is all it took. How she found her match? It is in the book.
Imagine you're sitting in the audience of a small theater in Manchester, England in 1841. Like everyone else, you've come expecting an evening of entertainment. A volunteer is invited onto the stage. He stares at a bright object held just above eye level. His blinking slows down. His face relaxes, and before long, he appears completely absorbed in the hypnotist's voice. Most people simply applaud and enjoy the show, but one man in the audience isn't watching for entertainment. He's studying every movement. His name is James Braid, a Scottish surgeon, and what he sees that night changes his life. After the performance, Braid isn't convinced that invisible magnetic forces are at work. In fact, he believes Mesmer has the explanation completely wrong. What if the real key isn't some mysterious force flowing from the hypnotist, but the incredible ability of the human mind to focus so completely that everything else fades into the background? That simple question marked the beginning of modern hypnosis. Braid returns home determined to find out for himself. He doesn't need mysterious tubs of water, metal rods, or dramatic music. Instead, he asks volunteers to focus their eyes on small, bright objects held just above their line of sight. As they continue staring, their eyelids grow heavy, blinking slows, outside distractions seem less important, and many enter the same unusual state Mesmer had described decades earlier. The difference is Braid believes nothing magical has happened. No invisible energy has passed from one person to the other. The change is happening deep inside the volunteer's own mind. Looking back, it seemed obvious, but at the time it was revolutionary. Hypnosis was beginning to move away from mysticism and toward psychology. Braid needed a name for what he was observing. Because many of his volunteers looked relaxed, peaceful, almost asleep, he borrowed the name of the Greek god of sleep, Hypnos, and called the process hypnosis. It seemed like the perfect choice. There's just one problem. He was wrong. The more Braid studied hypnosis, the more he realized people usually weren't asleep at all. They could hear conversations, they could answer questions. Many remembered everything afterward. In fact, years later, Braid admitted he wished he had chosen a completely different name. More than 180 years later, we're still using a word that its own creator believed was misleading. And that misunderstanding continues to confuse millions of people today. A few decades later, if you wanted to witness the latest discoveries about the brain, there was only one place to go: Paris. Physicians from across Europe packed into the lecture halls of the famous Salpêtrière Hospital. You can almost hear the wooden floor creak as another patient walks to the front of the room. The audience falls silent, standing beside the patient as one of France's most respected neurologists, Jean-Martin Charcot. Charcot speaks quietly to the young woman. Within minutes, her body becomes rigid. He gently lifts one arm, and it remains suspended in the air, exactly where he leaves it. Doctors lean forward. Some have never seen anything like it. Pens race across notebooks. Are they witnessing one of the greatest discoveries in medicine? Or could something else explain what they're seeing? Sitting among those physicians is a young Austrian doctor named Sigmund Freud. At this point, no one outside a small circle of colleagues knows who he is. He's simply just another physician trying to understand the mysteries of the human mind. Like everyone else in the room, Freud watches Charcot's demonstrations with fascination, wondering whether these hypnosis things that they're doing might unlock illnesses that medicine has never been able to explain. But several hundred miles away, another doctor is quietly reaching a very different conclusion. Hippolyte Bernheim isn't treating patients in front of crowded lecture halls. He's sitting beside ordinary people in a simple examination room, talking with them one-on-one. The more patients Bernheim sees, the more convinced he becomes that hypnosis isn't a rare medical condition at all. It may simply be a normal human ability, something that exists to one degree or another in almost everyone. Well, Freud returns to Vienna. He's excited by what he's witnessed in Paris, and he begins to use hypnosis with his own patients, hoping it will unlock painful memories and relieve emotional suffering. Some sessions are just remarkable. Patients remember forgotten events. Others describe emotions they've kept buried for years. A few feel like they've generally gotten better. He begins to wonder if hypnosis may become one of medicine's greatest breakthroughs. But the excitement doesn't last.
Some patients enter hypnosis easily, others can't seem to do it at all. Some improve, others don't. The results are simply too unpredictable. Rather than forcing every patient into hypnosis, Freud changes direction. He asks them to relax and simply talk, saying whatever comes to their minds. This decision gives birth to psychoanalysis. Ironically, while Freud leaves hypnosis behind, other physicians are just beginning to discover what it may actually be capable of. Fast forward to the middle of the 20th century. Instead of lecture halls, imagine walking into a hospital burn unit. A nurse is about to remove bandages from a patient whose skin has been badly burned. Even with powerful pain medication, everyone knows what's coming. The patient braces for pain. Then a clinician quietly begins guiding the patient through hypnosis, asking them to picture a peaceful place, to focus on breathing, to imagine injured skin becoming cool and comfortable. A few minutes later, something unexpected happens. The bandages come off, but the patient reports significantly less pain than anyone anticipated. Stories like this begin appearing in hospitals around the world. Doctors aren't interested in entertaining anyone. They want to know one thing: can hypnosis really help patients facing real medical problems? For the first time since Mesmer, hypnosis begins earning something it had struggled to gain for nearly two centuries: scientific credibility. By the middle of the 20th century, psychologists from around the world were traveling to Phoenix, Arizona, to study with an unusual psychiatrist named Milton Erickson. Many arrived carrying notebooks, expecting him to reveal the perfect hypnotic script, the exact words that would allow any therapist to hypnotize any patient. Erickson had very little interest in giving them what they wanted. One young psychiatrist made the trip expecting days of lectures. Instead, Erickson handed him a piece of paper with an address on it. "Go there." The young doctor looked puzzled. "Your house?" Erickson nodded. "There's a patient waiting for you at your house." Imagine how you would have felt. You come to observe one of the world's greatest therapists, and instead, you're about to treat one of his patients. No lecture, no demonstration, no instructions. Just a patient waiting for you to begin. The lesson became legendary. Erickson believed great therapists don't hide behind scripts because no two people are exactly alike. Hypnosis wasn't about memorizing magic words. It was about paying attention, building trust, and helping each individual use the remarkable abilities that already existed within their own mind. We'll talk more about this when we come back.
Soon she went on a perfect date, and then she knew it must be fate. In just 90 days, that is all it took. How she found her match? It is in the book.
Welcome back to 90 Day Soulmate. If I hypnotized you right now, would it work? That's probably the first question most people ask, and the answer may surprise you. Imagine walking into a university laboratory. No swinging watches, no mysterious music, no dramatic stage lights. A researcher simply asks volunteers to relax, follow a few instructions, and imagine a series of ordinary experiences. One person says their arm feels so heavy they can't lift it. Another insists their fingers feel glued together. A third shrugs and says, "Nothing happened." Everyone received the same instructions, yet everyone had different experiences. That's exactly what researchers have found. Hypnotic responses exist on a spectrum. A small percentage of people are highly responsive. Some experience hypnosis moderately well. Others respond very little, if at all. That doesn't mean someone is weak-minded, gullible, or unintelligent. In fact, many highly hypnotizable people are exceptionally good at concentrating and using their imagination. The real question isn't whether hypnosis works on everyone, because it doesn't. The better question is, why are some minds naturally more responsive than others? Now, imagine you're one of the volunteers sitting in the laboratory. The researcher says, "When I count to three, your right arm will begin to feel lighter." almost as though a balloon is gently lifting it in the air. You smile to yourself. There's no way that's going to happen. But after a few moments, something feels different. Your shoulder relaxes. Tiny muscles you weren't even aware of begin making subtle adjustments. Before long, your arm slowly starts to rise. You don't even know you're raising it yet. It doesn't feel like a deliberate decision. The strange feeling has fascinated psychologists for decades. Hypnosis doesn't usually take away your awareness. Instead, many people describe it as allowing an experience to unfold without constantly analyzing it. It's like becoming absorbed in a great novel that you stop noticing the room around you. Or you're driving several miles before you suddenly realize you don't remember the last few turns, or you've missed your turn because you were focused on something else. We experience states like this more often than we realize. If hypnosis isn't mind control, then why do stage hypnotists make it look that way? Imagine sitting in the audience before the show even begins. The hypnotist asks for volunteers, but not just any. He watches carefully who rushes to the stage, who laughs easily, who seems excited rather than skeptical. Within minutes, he's already learning something about the personalities in front of him. The show begins, and after a few simple exercises, several volunteers are quietly thanked and sent back to their seats. The audience hardly notices. The hypnotist isn't looking for failures. He's looking for people that responded most strongly. By the time someone is pretending they're an opera singer or forgetting the number 7, you're no longer watching a random group of volunteers. You're watching the handful of people who prove to be most responsive and who are comfortable performing in front of hundreds of strangers. That's not deception. It's good showmanship. But it also explains why stage hypnosis often gives people the wrong impression of what hypnosis really is. So here's another question. Could a hypnotist make me rob a bank? It's a fair question because movies have been telling us that story for decades. The villain snaps his fingers. The victim's eyes glaze over, and suddenly an ordinary person becomes mindless and a puppet carrying out criminal orders. You know, in reality, it's far less dramatic. If hypnosis truly gave one person complete control over another, police departments, intelligence agencies, and militaries around the world would be using it every day. They don't, because it doesn't work that way. Under hypnosis, people can become deeply focused, highly imaginative, more willing to follow reasonable suggestions. But that doesn't mean they lose their values, their judgment, or their ability to choose. The evidence consistently shows that hypnosis isn't a shortcut around conscious. Don't become simply someone else. You are still you. Which brings us one of the most controversial chapters in the history of hypnosis. During the Cold War, rumors spread of governments who were searching for ways to control the human mind. Newspapers talked about brainwashing. Books described secret experiments. Movies imagined spies programmed to assassinate world leaders with nothing more than a whispered phrase or a flipped card. Many of these government agency programs were real. Intelligence agencies, including the CIA, explored hypnosis alongside drugs and other techniques, hoping they may discover new methods for gathering information or influencing behavior. They spent years and a great deal of money looking for a reliable form of mind control, maybe even wasting money, but they never found one. If hypnosis could truly force ordinary people to betray their beliefs or carry out impossible commands, those programs would have changed history. Instead, they became another reminder of how easily myth can grow far beyond scientific evidence. If you've ever been hypnotized or you've watched somebody who has, you may have noticed something surprising. They don't look unconscious. They don't look asleep. In fact, many people carry on perfectly normal conversations while hypnotized. They answer questions, they laugh at jokes, they remember what happened afterward. So what exactly is changing? Imagine sitting comfortably in a chair with a good novel in your hands. A few pages turn. You know, you go into a couple of chapters and someone calls your name from across the room and you don't hear them. The television is still on. People are walking past you. nothing around you has disappeared. Your brain has simply decided that the story in front of you is more important than everything else. You've filtered everything else out. Hypnosis appears to work in the same way. Your attention becomes so focused on one experience that distractions begin to fade into the background. You're not asleep. You're not unconscious. You're simply paying attention in a very different way. So today, instead of guessing what's happening during hypnosis, scientists can actually walk. They can what? What can they do? Today, instead of guessing what's happening during hypnosis, scientists can actually watch the brain at work. Imagine lying inside an MRI scanner. The machine hums while researchers ask you to imagine your hand becoming warm, or your arm becoming lighter, or your pain gradually fading away. From the outside, almost nothing seems to be happening. But inside your brain, however, millions of nerve cells are changing the way they communicate with each other. Brain imaging studies suggest hypnosis isn't shutting the brain off. It's just changing the way different parts of the brain work together. Regions involved in attention become more focused. Areas involved in monitoring distractions become less active. In other words, the brain isn't losing control. It's just reorganizing how that control is being used. That's a very different picture from the myths we've seen in movies. And it helps explain why hypnosis has become increasingly accepted in medicine and in psychology. Why does it feel so real? Imagine you're watching a suspense movie late at night. The room is quiet and someone slowly reaches for a doorknob. And before anything has ever happened, your heart begins to race. Your breathing changes. Your muscles tighten. You know you're sitting safely in your living room, but you know the movie isn't real, yet your body is responding as though the danger were unfolding right in front of you. That's an important clue to understanding what hypnosis really is. As we've discussed on previous programs, your brain is constantly deciding what deserves your full attention. During hypnosis, that spotlight becomes more focused. While distractions and internal chatter begin to fade, you're not unconscious and you haven't lost control. Instead, your mind becomes more absorbed in the experience. When that happens, a suggestion can become vivid enough that your brain begins responding as though it were happening in the moment. Once researchers understood this, the question was no longer whether hypnosis was real, but how that ability could be used to help people. From a curiosity to the clinic, picture yourself sitting in a dentist chair. Your last visit ended before the procedure even began because the anxiety became overwhelming. This time, before anyone reaches for an instrument, the dentist simply asked you to focus on your breathing, your attention, and your imagination. Several minutes later, you're calmer, and much calmer than you ever thought possible. The procedure begins, and you make it all the way through. Stories like this helped move hypnosis out of theaters and into hospitals, dental offices, pain clinics, and psychologists' practices. It isn't used because patients are unconscious. They're not. It isn't used because it works for everyone. It doesn't. It's used because decades of research have shown that, you know, for the right person and the right problem, focused attention and therapeutic suggestion can reduce pain. It can ease anxiety. It can improve coping and become a valuable partner to conventional medical care. Hypnosis isn't magic, but neither is it a myth. Using it responsibly, it can earn a legitimate place in modern healthcare. We talked a little bit about, does hypnosis work for everyone? And can it reduce pain and ease anxiety and help people overcome certain challenges? Well, it does, but it doesn't work the same way for everyone. And it's surprisingly simple. Why not? People differ in how readily they undergo hypnosis. Most people can experience to some degree. Some enter a deep, focused hypnotic state, while others experience just a modest effect. A small percentage respond very little, and that doesn't mean anyone has failed, but it simply reminds us that every brain is unique. Good doctors and clinicians understand these differences. They don't promise miracles, but instead they combine it, the hypnosis, with other proven treatments, using it when appropriate for the individual based upon the individual. Like any medical or psychological tool, success depends on the right technique, the right situation, and the right person. So can someone force you to undergo hypnosis? You're sitting in the audience of a stage hypnotism show. The hypnotist steps forward and dramatically announces, "When I point to you, you will come to the stage." Some people laugh. Some eagerly volunteer. Others remain comfortable in their seats without the slightest urge to move. Before the demonstration has even begun, you've already witnessed one of the biggest truths about hypnosis. Despite what movies and television often suggest, no one can force you to undergo hypnosis against your will, like we talked about. The most successful participants are almost always willing, curious, and cooperative from the beginning. They choose to participate. Through hypnosis, they remain capable of rejecting suggestions that conflict with their values, or simply they can choose to end their experience. Hypnotism may look like one person controlling another, but hypnosis is really a partnership. The hypnotist provides guidance. The participant's mind does the work. Can you go under hypnosis yourself? You may be surprised to learn that many psychologists believe the most important person involved in hypnosis isn't the therapist, it's you. Think about that for a minute. Through this program, we've seen that hypnosis isn't something mysterious flowing from one person to another. It isn't a special power possessed by a hypnotist. The focused attention, the vivid imagination, the changes taking place in the brain, they're all happening inside the person undergoing hypnosis. That's why many clinicians teach self-hypnosis. Rather than relying on someone's voice or someone else, they learn to guide their own attention. They learn to quiet distracting thoughts, and they can use mental imagery to relax, manage stress, or prepare for difficult situations. In many ways, the therapist becomes less of a magician and more of a coach. They help people discover abilities that they've already possessed. Let's separate self-hypnosis from meditation. At this point, another question comes up. Isn't this just meditation? It's an understandable question because both involve relaxation, focused attention, and turning inward. From the outside, they can even look very similar, but their goals are often quite different. Meditation usually encourages observing thoughts without judging, allowing them to come and go naturally. Hypnosis, on the other hand, it's typically more goal-directed. It uses focused attention and carefully chosen suggestions to help accomplish something specific, reducing anxiety, managing pain, changing a habit, or improving performance. They're not competitors, and in fact, many people benefit from both. They simply take different paths towards improving mental well-being. Hypnosis beyond medicine. Imagine standing behind the starting blocks at the Olympic Games. 4 years of training have led to this one race. The roar of the crowd fades into the background as the runner quietly closes her eyes. She isn't stretching. She isn't resting. She's mentally running the race in her head. Every stride, every turn, every breath, every push off the blocks, every step through the finish line. By the time she settles into her position, her mind has already completed the race dozens of times. Elite athletes have long understood that performance isn't only physical, it's mental. Today, hypnosis and guided mental rehearsal are used by some athletes, musicians, surgeons, performers, business leaders, and this helps them sharpen concentration, reduce anxiety, perform more consistently under pressure. They still have to do the work. They still need the talent and the preparation. Hypnosis doesn't create the ability. It helps some people make better use of the abilities they already possess. Let's use hypnosis responsibly. Whatever a treatment, and whenever it is beginning to attract attention, someone eventually claims it can solve almost every problem. And hypnosis has never escaped that temptation. Some promise instant cures, perfect memories, dramatic life changes after a single session. Others dismiss hypnosis completely without ever looking at the scientific evidence. Neither extreme reflects good science. Responsible clinicians begin somewhere else. They first ask, what is causing the problem? Could it be a medical condition, a medication, depression, anxiety, or something else entirely? Only after understanding the individual do they decide whether hypnosis may be appropriate. That's why hypnosis works best as part of the comprehensive care, not instead of medicine or psychology. But alongside them, like any other professional tool, its value depends on when it's used, why it's used, and who is using it.
Tired of attracting the wrong type of guy, it was time to give something else a try. She got her computer and started to plan and created a process to find her man. Soon she went on a perfect date, and then she knew it must be fate. In just 90 days, that is all it took. How she found her match? It is in the book.
Welcome back to 90 Day Soulmate. So what has hypnosis taught us about the human mind? Why the myths refuse to die? If science has answered so many questions, why do the myths surrounding it still survive? Why do so many people still picture swinging pocket watches, glowing eyes, and mysterious mind control? After more than two centuries of investigation, why hasn't the truth completely replaced the fiction? Well, part of the answer is surprisingly simple. Myths are much better entertainment. A stage show is more exciting if it appears one person controls another. Movies become more suspenseful when hypnosis is portrayed as a dangerous weapon. These stories stay with us because they appeal to emotion, not evidence. Yet the real story never depended on stage performances or Hollywood scripts. As scientific evidence accumulated, hypnosis gradually moved from theaters into hospitals, universities, and research laboratories. The mystery became smaller, while our understanding of the human mind became larger. And as I always say, the more you know about the human mind, the more you don't know about the human mind. The real discovery, thinking back to where we began, a stage hypnotist appeared to control complete strangers. Volunteers barked like dogs, forgot their names, and convinced audiences they had surrendered their free will. It was entertaining. It was astonishing even, but it also raised an important question. What really is hypnosis? What is it? How does it work? After traveling through more than two centuries of history, and science, we've discovered something very different. The real story was never about mysterious powers or one person controlling another. It was about understanding how the human mind focuses attention, shapes perception, influences the body, and changes behavior in ways that scientists are still exploring today. Perhaps the greatest discovery wasn't hypnosis itself, but it was realizing that most extraordinary subject in this journey, and the one that fascinates us completely, is the remarkable human mind. What scientists are still trying to answer? You might think that after more than 200 years, scientists would know everything there is to know about hypnosis. But surprisingly, they don't. Every year, researchers continue exploring how focused attention, it influences pain, it influences learning, memory, emotions, decision-making, and even the way the different regions of the brain communicate with one another. Their questions haven't disappeared. They've simply become more sophisticated. As we learn more, we find out that we have more to learn. So today's researchers are no longer asking whether hypnosis is real. The question has largely been answered. Instead, they're asking who benefits the most from hypnosis, why some people respond more strongly than others, and how hypnosis can be used more effectively and ethically in medicine and psychology. That's the true nature of good science. Every answer creates better and more questions. Every discovery brings us one step closer to understanding ourselves, which in this case causes us to understand less about ourselves because we have more questions. Let's have some caution here. Imagine seeing an advertisement that promises hypnosis can cure every illness, recover forgotten memories, unlock hidden genius, or completely transform your life in a single afternoon. It does sound impressive, but extraordinary claims have always surrounded hypnosis. The difference today is that we know how to separate persuasive marketing from credible science. Ethical professionals explain both the possibilities and include the limitations of hypnosis. They rely on evidence instead of promises. They recognize that hypnosis isn't appropriate for every person or every problem. They encourage informed decisions rather than blind belief. Ironically, the practitioners most deserving of your trust are the ones that make the fewest dramatic claims.
Soon she went on a perfect date, and then she knew it must be fate. In just 90 days, that is all it took. How she found her match? It is in the book.
Throughout this journey, we've talked about physicians and psychologists and researchers and hospitals and laboratories. But behind every experiment, every discovery, and every scientific paper, there's been one subject of study. Not hypnosis itself, but the human mind. The same mind that allowed you to become absorbed in a novel, lose yourself in music, replay yesterday's memories, sometimes too often, or imagine tomorrow's possibilities, is the very mind that makes hypnosis possible. Perhaps that's why this story continues to fascinate us. It really isn't a story about hypnosis. It's a story about ourselves and what our capabilities are and how much we have to learn about the most complex organ in the known universe. What should we take away from everything we've learned so far? Maybe the answer is simpler than we expected. The greatest lesson isn't that hypnosis is extraordinary. It's that the human mind is extraordinary. Every day, your brain filters information, shapes your perceptions, influences your emotions, and helps you determine how to experience the world around you. Hypnosis simply gives scientists another window through which to study that remarkable process. And perhaps that's the real surprise. The greatest mystery was never hypnosis itself. It's always been the remarkable mind that each of us has and carries with us every day. Why is hypnosis not for everyone? If hypnosis has been studied for more than two centuries and has legitimate medical and psychological applications, why then is not everyone using it? The answer is the same one you'll hear about almost every evidence-based treatment in medicine. No single approach works equally well for every person. Your mileage may vary. People differ in personality. They differ in attention, motivation, expectations, and even their willingness to participate. Some experience hypnosis quite readily, others respond more gradually, and some very little at all. That doesn't mean hypnosis fails. It just means that we're all wonderfully different. Good clinicians don't force a technique simply because it exists. They choose the right approach for the right person at the right time. Hypnosis isn't a universal answer, but it's one valuable tool among many. And knowing when not to use it is just as important as knowing when it may help. What has hypnosis given medicine? Well, imagine walking into a hospital where every treatment focused on only medications and surgery. Today, that would seem incomplete. Modern medicine recognizes that thoughts, emotions, expectations, and stress all influence health in meaningful ways. We now treat the whole patient. Hypnosis helped encourage that broader perspective. It reminded physicians that treating the person sometimes means addressing both the body and the mind. Used appropriately, hypnosis has become one option for helping some patients manage pain, reduce anxiety, prepare for procedures, or cope with chronic conditions. It doesn't replace medicine, it complements it, and perhaps that's one of the most important lessons medicine has learned. Healing is more effective when we understand the whole person. If someone promises hypnosis can cure every illness, recover every forgotten memory, reveal past lives, solve every problem, ask for evidence. Healthy skepticism isn't cynicism, it's curiosity combined with critical thinking. Science welcomes questions because good ideas become stronger when they're tested honestly. The goal was never to convince you to believe in hypnosis. The goal was to encourage you to think the same way scientists do, by following the evidence wherever it leads, even when it challenges our assumptions. For me, it was to understand what's the difference between hypnotism and hypnosis. And is there an overlap? What does this mean to me? Throughout this review, we've separated myth from science. We've explored history. We've examined the evidence. And we've followed hypnosis from stage performances into hospitals, clinics, research laboratories. But after all of that, one question remains. What does this mean to me? Now, the answer may be simpler than you expected. Every day, your attention influences what you notice and what you don't. Your expectations shape how you interpret events. Your emotions affect your decisions. Your beliefs influence your confidence. Hypnosis didn't create those abilities. It simply helps scientists understand them more clearly. Perhaps the greatest value of studying hypnosis isn't learning how to enter a hypnotic state. It's gaining a better understanding of how your own mind works every single day. Because the better we understand ourselves, the better prepared we are to make thoughtful decisions and respond more effectively to everyday challenges. The greatest discovery. At the beginning of this program today, hypnosis appeared to be the mystery. It seemed mysterious, almost supernatural, and for generations, people searched for an invisible force that could explain it. But as the evidence accumulated, something unexpected happened. The closer scientists examined hypnosis, the less mysterious it became. Instead, their attention shifted to something far more remarkable, the human mind itself. Researchers gradually realized that hypnosis was revealing just how adaptable, flexible, and complex the human mind truly is. In many ways, hypnosis became less of a destination and more of a doorway to this new information, one that continues to lead psychology and neuroscience toward a deeper understanding of what makes us human. Hypnosis is not magic. It isn't mind control. It isn't a mysterious force that allows one person to take control of another. It's a genuine psychological phenomenon that has earned its place in modern medicine, psychology, and in scientific research. But perhaps the greatest discovery was in hypnosis itself. Throughout today's journey, hypnosis has simply been the window. The real subject has always been the remarkable human mind. Its ability to focus, adapt, imagine, learn, continually surprise us. And the more we discover about the mind, the more we realize there is still so much left to understand. Thank you for joining me on 90 Day Soulmate. I'm Jim Golnick. Until next time, take care.
You're listening to 90 Day Soulmate with the relationship engineers, Jim Golnick and Lisette Guevara, only on LA Talk Radio.